welcome to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. I'm here with my compadre in engineering, Egberto Willis, who has his show Thursdays at 3 p.m. Politics Done Right, or as I have now heard him already elevate it, PDR. I love that. He can't even say the full name of his own show. Now when he discusses it, it's PDR. I'm waiting for him to start talking about it in the third person. Then we'll know he has gone Hollywood. Okay, we're going to have open forum tonight, 713-526-5738. We have, needless to say, open lines. Hold on a second, I got to straighten out a monitor here. Okay, that's moderately better. Okay, so possible things we might want to discuss. Elections. I am told we had a 27% turnout. I'm curious, Egberto, was that, because I didn't get the numbers, was that 27% Harris County or Texas?
I am not sure, to be honest with you. I am not sure.
Whichever number it is, for a so-called off-year election, that's actually pretty impressive.
Actually, though, I can tell you one thing.
It sucks.
I can tell you one thing that I read for a fact, and that is, the early vote was twice as high as the last non-incumbent mayoral election, which speaks highly of what hate can bring out.
Well, you know, I've said this before, many things I've said before. You'll just have to bear with me. I'm getting old. 90% of your complaints in business come from 10% of your customers. Now, let's evaluate that. It's kind of a truism. Why is it a truism? Well, think about it. When was the last time that you walked into a store, found exactly what you needed, paid for it, the price was fair, you got home, you opened the box, it worked fine, and then you called the store or the company and said, hey, you know what? I just had a great shopping experience. I found what I needed. I got courteous help when I required it. I was able to check out quickly, and when I got home, the freaking thing wasn't broken. By the way, I recently bought something that was broken, so that's kind of top of mind for me. How often do people do that? The answer is pretty much never. Now, I come from a business background, many and varied businesses. My family goes back two or three generations in various kinds of retail. My father was in retail. My stepfather was in retail. My mother was in retail. I've been in a trade where I had to do wholesale and retail services. Then I was in retail sales for like 11 years. So I've been in retail. And I will tell you that compliments are so rare in customer service businesses, speaking both for myself and for others, that when someone says to you, you are such a tremendous help and I really appreciate it, it literally, and I'm not joking, it literally can bring tears to your eyes. Now think about that. Think about, and I'm sure this goes toward many businesses, and particularly the customer service department in any business. Think about what it means when a compliment from anybody, even your boss, when a heartfelt compliment is so rare that it literally brings tears to your eyes. Think about what it means when someone tells a customer service person, I want to speak to your manager, and the first thing they assume is I did something wrong, rather than you want to give me a compliment to my manager. One of the things I have learned, and I have taken it as a matter of faith in my life. Now, this is funny coming from an agnostic / atheist, okay? But this is a matter of faith for me. I strongly believe that positive behavior should be reinforced. I grew up in an environment of negative reinforcement. I do not believe in negative reinforcement. I understand the harm it does. I am not reluctant to complain when I feel that I've been treated unfairly or poorly. But I believe very strongly, again, as an article of faith, that when you are treated well, you should also say something. If you are treated particularly well, You should not only compliment the person who treated you well, you should talk to their boss and say, I just want to talk to you about Jim or Sally. You know what? They bent over backwards to help me, and I had this problem, and I had no idea how to resolve it. And, boy, I just want to tell you how great they were. Because I want to tell you something. When you ask for a manager, the first thing the employee assumes is it's going to be a compliment. And the first thing the manager assumes, I'm sorry, not a compliment, a complaint is what I meant, okay? The first thing they assume is a complaint. And the first thing the manager assumes is a complaint. And when I have done this and spoken to managers and supervisors and complimented the person that I worked with who works under them, I can't tell you how shocked they are. Now, it doesn't bring tears to their eyes because the compliment wasn't directed specifically to them. But the fact that it's shocking, to me, says that societally, we have a problem. I used to talk about, I'm not going to mention the company, although people who know me well won't be surprised, but there was a company that I worked for that the district management particularly had what I called the 2 feet up the butt school of management. They put you through excruciating pain if you either did something wrong or if they felt you weren't meeting a goal. But there was very little compliment, very little genuine from the heart or any positive reinforcement for maybe something you didn't, maybe something you did that didn't meet a goal, but maybe something you did that made somebody happy. Making people happy is what makes you money in business. Most sales transactions aren't based solely on price or solely on features or solely on brands, because very often you can buy that in any number of places. You ask any salesperson who knows anything about sales and they will tell you that selling is a relationship business. I don't care where you work. I don't care if you work at Target or Sears or Mercedes. Wherever you work, if you're selling something, they can buy it from anybody. Buying it from you makes it a relationship business. I don't know how I got off on this. I really had other things I wanted to talk about. This was like not on my list at all. But I think this is a really, really important thing. All of us need to take this to heart. Be willing to complain, but be willing to compliment. You must do both, okay? So, we have open lines, 713-526-5738. At one point, and we do have a caller. I'm going to get to you in a moment, Greg. Egberto wanted to make a comment. I don't know if we ran so far past that point that maybe...
No. It still falls into that realm. I mean, I think it is important that, as you mentioned, in fact, that is something that I think a lot of us in my groups have been trying to do for a while, and that is start complimenting the positives. Now, if you look at our society, we've been giving rouse to people who are successful after failure, but a lot of times we don't give people who have continuously been doing the right things the kudos that they need. So I think it's important that what you said is absolutely correct. As an example, we have a basketball coach who was on dope. He recovered several different times, and he's made a hero for having done that. We have the coaches that have lived stellar lives and done great things, and nobody ever really gives them the uplift that they so desire.
I will tell you, and Greg, I promise, I will tell you just how fundamental I take this article of faith. When I am driving, whether or not traffic is heavy, especially if traffic is heavy, but if I need to change lanes, and somebody lets me change lanes without giving me a hard time, you know, accelerating or whatever, I will always wave conspicuously. I take literally a second to wave my hand above the seat so that even at night, the light coming from the other direction, they can see that I'm waving. I want them to know that at least for once, somebody said thank you and makes them so they don't feel like somebody just cut them off and whatever. Okay, I'm going to get to Greg now. Greg, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Doing fantastic. I was listening to part of what you were saying, and I think the reason that people kind of love the stories of the person who failed and then succeeded the second time is for a lot of people, that's kind of if you have like a faith script, it's kind of a redemptive story for some people. Whereas, like, one of the greatest coaches in the history of basketball was John Wooden. And he's probably respected by most people who maybe aren't even sports fans. And probably the biggest reason that he had so much respect over the years, even in his later years after he quit coaching, was just the values that he carried with him. And I think part of it is, too, we've been conditioned to think the only way you'll be a success is if you do certain types of things.
If you walk over people.
Yeah, or you behave a certain way. And people forget that John Wooden never had to raise his voice publicly in front of people. Or maybe a guy like a Tom Landry, you know, the late coach of the Cowboys. Everybody just has a different way of looking at things. And maybe it's the way we've been taught. And it shows up in every aspect of our lives, whether it's politics, the larger society, whether it's business, or whatever we try to do. We have to get over ourselves a little bit and remember that we had to have somebody to help us get there. It wasn't just us.
We didn't do it alone.
Didn't do it alone.
We didn't build it. Okay, part of it was built for us or with us.
Yeah, and maybe that's been the problem over the last 35 to 40-plus years is that's been the mindset.
You know, I agree with what you're saying, and I'm just going to digress slightly here. I'm a science fiction and fantasy fan, but my favorite movie is The Natural. Now, a lot of people, have you seen The Natural?
Yeah, I've seen The Natural.
It's a
before.
Wonderful movie, great cast, an A-list cast. And it's a lot of people think of it as a baseball movie, so that people who are not into sports movies, you know, I'm not going to watch that. But you're talking about redemption. If I were to write the TV Guide synopsis for that movie, it would be about a young man who has a great gift and great potential, and because of bad luck and bad people and bad choices, it looks like he's going to be cheated out of what might be his right in life based on his gifts. But at the end, he manages to achieve at least part of that greatness. That's a story of human redemption, and that's a story I think that resonates for a lot of people for the same reason that you're talking about, because all of us have struggled. Some of us never succeed to a degree that we consider satisfactory. Many of us don't. So when, I think that's what brings tears to our eyes when we share a story like that or experience a moment like that when someone says you've done a great job when everyone is always giving you a hard time.
Yeah, I mean, redemptive stories are kind of what makes us feel good, because it's not to say that the person who hasn't been, who's been successful and done it the right way doesn't get praise. They do, but I think it's, for a lot of people, it's that thrill, that excitement that you go, wow, this person came from a horrific struggle and made it, or, you know, they've had obstacles to overcome, whether they've had a disability or whatnot, and they've shown a bright light to people, and they've been an inspiration. I mean, it's just, I think people love those stories because we can say, hey, that could be me.
I think most of us, and I'm going to let you go after this because I have a couple of other folks, which I always appreciate. I think one of the things to remember, and I think you get it, but the way you're expressing it, I don't think quite says it. All of us have to overcome obstacles to achieve whatever we do or do not achieve. All of us, with a very, very tiny exception. I mean, I was amazed when I was in retail how many people would say to me, they'd start a sentence with my luck. So now I hear all these people, and I'm among them, with my luck, blah, 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 blah. And it makes me wonder, well, if that's how everybody feels, who the heck has the luck?
True.
Where is the luck if everyone is saying with my luck, and then they figure some kind of a downbeat story? So somebody, you see, the 1%, there's the lucky 1%. So that's where I guess the luck goes. I don't know.
Me neither.
All right. Thanks so much for calling, Greg. You take care. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your Pacifica station. Remember, you can help support the station at kpft.org. Drop something in the tip jar and say that Think Wing Radio sent you. It doesn't hurt me. Might help a little. Okay, and I've got Egberto Willis here. He is engineering and contributing a little to the show when he feels I'm not quite touching enough bases. He does his show, PDR. Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4. And also remember, Greg Berg does a great, great show Fridays from 3 to 4.
Jeff Berg.
Ugh, you see, I was talking to Greg. So I merged in my old, aged head. Jeff Berg.
He does have.
What? I can never remember the name
Partisan
of the show.
Partisan Gridlock.
Partisan Gridlock. You see, my brain was gridlocked on that. Jeff Berg, Partisan Gridlock. He does a great show. Really just first class. Okay. Jerry, you're up. How are you doing tonight, Jerry?
All right. How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
That's good. I don't know. I wanted to actually address something that you actually brought up here a couple of weeks ago. On about immigration and about how we don't get the people that we expect to get and everything and all that. What's funny is everybody complains about all the illegal aliens from Mexico, but, you know, what you should turn around and do is ask them, you know, would you prefer, you know, to have Muslims and you know, Hindus, you know, from India and, you know, basically like the Middle East.
Non-Judeo-Christians.
And people from, yeah, and people from the Far East and all that who, you know, basically, by the way, that's the profile, in fact, of what's going to wind up happening. We're going to see less and less immigrants. We're going to see less and less people coming over from Mexico. We're going to see more and more people coming over from the East.
I think we're going to see people coming from further south. We already are. And, yes, I think we see people coming from Asia. You touch on an interesting thing because it's something I keep meaning to talk about but somehow keep getting detoured. You look at the immigration crisis in Europe. Now, the first thing I'll say is no country likes uncontrolled immigration. The United States is horrible with massive immigration. We're not exactly the most generous spiritual country in the world when, you know, we have, like, people coming from Central America who are trying to escape with their lives, like, no, send them back. But I think that when you compound that with a culturally and ethnically alien group, you know, you have this relatively homogeneous Christian continent. And, of course, it's relatively homogeneous partly because during World War II they killed two-thirds of the Jews in the world, or maybe one-third, but a lot. So very few Jews, mostly various flavors of Christian. And now all of a sudden you don't have Catholics coming over. You don't have Protestants coming over. You don't even have Russian Orthodox coming over. All of a sudden you've got Muslims. So you've got this huge influx, which they don't want anyway, any huge influx. And this huge influx is Muslim, which means they're going to have language adaptations. They're going to have cultural adaptations. They're going to have cultural conflicts. I mean, even things like hand gestures in different parts of the world, if they're different enough, mean totally different things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's something no one dares say. I've not heard anyone actually really say it, certainly not the countries involved. But at the end of the day, it's not only the numbers, which are a problem, but it's the fact that it's Muslim numbers, which adds to the problem.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, everybody, like I said, sits there and complains about Hispanics and everything. And they think, you know, well, we'll just build this wall. You know, there's lots of Tea Party people who are, like, gung-ho for Trump because they want to see that wall built. That wall's never going to get built.
Of course.
Let me give you a clue.
And if it is built, the Mexicans ain't paying for it.
Yeah, that's just it. Yeah, and that's another thing, too. If by some remote chance it does get built, we'll have to pay for it. Bingo.
Everyone has to remember we have the longest non-militarized borders in the world. Why screw with that?
Yeah. No,
I don't get it. It's crazy. I will also say that when you look at immigration, and I mean, I understand immigration is a complicated thing, whether it's legal or illegal, but the people that come to the United States from wherever, these are a self-selected group of more energetic, more ambitious, more hopeful people.
Yeah.
They are, whatever Trump thinks, on some level or other, most of them are the cream of their country. Because they're the ones that are really willing to go out there and do something, you know, a dramatic, dangerous, hard adventure. I mean, when I moved from New York to Texas, and I didn't know anything, and I didn't know anyone, and I didn't know any place, for me, that was a difficult adjustment that took a couple of years. I can only imagine coming from a country with a different culture, different total religion, different language, different everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like orders of magnitude even harder.
Yeah.
So I think we're actually getting some of the best, even if they're undereducated, relatively ignorant by our standards. I personally have never met a lazy Mexican.
Now,
the Mexicans that are here, they're not lazy Mexicans. They work.
Yeah, that's just it. And everything. I grew up in El Paso, and I was born and raised out in West Texas, but I grew up pretty much in El Paso, and everything. And, you know, basically that, yeah, you know, basically all those people worked their, you know,
they worked their butts off.
All of them did, but all of them did work, and you know, none of them sat there and expected somebody to give them something. It didn't seem like to me anyway.
Now, my wife is a legal immigrant, and she is a legal naturalized citizen. And many of our friends are as well. They're either, they've got resident visas, work visas, green cards, or citizenship. They take, my wife and others, take illegal immigration very seriously because if you've never known someone going through the immigration process, you have no idea how hard it is and how expensive it is.
Oh, yeah. And it costs thousands of dollars.
Thousands.
Actually, it can cost tens of thousands of dollars.
It can. Exactly. But even for the average person, it's going to cost $5,000 to $10,000 from the beginning to the end at a minimum. And, you just have to go through the ICE stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable. The State Department stuff. So when someone simply crosses, I say simply, I take the word advisedly. When someone simply crosses the border and maybe enters a cash economy, and then people start talking about giving them legal residency, you know, some kind of amnesty. And, I mean, I realize I'm using words that can be politically loaded, and I'm not meaning them in that way.
No, I know.
But they resent it. And I get that she resents it, and I get why she resents it. But then you get to the other question. Well, now what's done is done. What do you do with 16 million people? So there has to be. Now, the Republicans talk about we need to secure the border. And there is a conservative caller whose name I won't mention. He's basically a nice guy. I like him. We just disagree. And I have asked the question that I have never gotten the answer to. How secure does the border have to be before you consider it secure? Is it 1,000 illegal immigrants a year? Is it 100? Is it one? You know.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
So they don't have a standard. All they keep throwing this term around, but there's no way to quantify it.
Yeah.
We have a pretty secure border right now. We really do.
Yeah.
Historically speaking.
It's not militarized or, you know, got a wall on it or anything like that.
Exactly.
That's basically true.
And, of course, this amazing invention that they have, I think it's called a ladder.
Yeah.
And I'm told that you can use that to get over a wall, although I've, you know, never seen it. So, anyway. All right. I've been doing a lot of.
The whole thing is, you know, basically, though, is that basically the United States. This goes back to the education thing, too, that I was going to discuss. But first I wanted to say a few things about immigration and about what's going on population-wise in the U.S., because basically you have to have a context when you start talking about education and about issues revolving around that and training and stuff like that. But the thing about it is, you know, basically this country can, you know, basically is able to take on, can take a whole lot more people than it's got. And everything. This is one of the few countries with any real capacity to actually take significant numbers of, you know, significant number of people from overseas and make them citizens or whatever. And in fact, that's going to be a necessity. Why? Once again, this begins to dovetail into the whole education thing. You know, basically everybody's heard these numbers before, but, you know, 900,000 new teachers over the next decade or so, or less now, maybe.
Well, now keep in mind, we're going to have to pay them with tax money.
We're not producing them.
Well, I think that the birth rate in the United States among native-born citizens is like 1.97 children per woman, and the replacement rate is 2.11. We talked about this. Without immigration, our population would be declining.
Yeah. And everything, and we'd be older, too.
And we'd be older, and, you know, China, I haven't had a chance to talk about this. It's just a topic I haven't gotten to, but China, because of their one-child policy.
Oh, yeah, they're having serious trouble.
Beginning about now and going on for probably the next half century at a minimum, they have a major demographic collapse beginning.
Yeah.
And on one hand, in the long run, it'll be great, because instead of having 3 billion people, they'll have 1 billion people. But it's going to be a really tough transition for them. And, you know, from a geopolitical standpoint, you could argue that they are about as powerful now as they will ever be because they're going to go in, they're going to have some serious social unrest.
Well, they're going to have some serious, you're right about that, they're going to have some serious social unrest, but they've got actually a range of problems. They're going to get old before they get rich. That's an old saw, but it's basically true. They're going to get old before they get rich, almost certainly. They're also going to have other issues, too. For one thing, they're looking at, and everybody that I read sits there and fully expects, thinks that basically China's sitting on a bubble or two that when they burst, you know, we're going to be sad. We're going to be crying in our beer. It's going to be that bad.
We'll see.
And all that. And but it's going to be a disaster for China. And I think that's one of the reasons why Xi Jinping, in fact, has been going after people preemptively on the whole, on the whole corruption thing and all that. I think that he's trying to clear the house kind of preemptively.
I agree with you. I think he's trying to position China so it's in a good position when these various crises that are demographically based begin to come up.
No, he's trying to position the Communist Party is what's happening.
Well, China, Communist Party, they consider that to be synonymous. I'm going to let you go,
it's
Jerry.
Not,
it's not.
I got a lot more to say about all this stuff. And like I said, a lot of this dovetails in with education, but I'll talk to you again. I'll call next week or whatever.
Appreciate it. Or, if it's slow later, maybe you call the last 10 minutes. We'll see.
All right. Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Take care.
All right.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Koenig. I'm here with my engineer, Eric Bader Willis, who does PDR Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m., Politics Done Right. And Jeff Berg, of course, on Fridays 3 to 4, does his terrific show, Partisan Gridlock. And Mike, sorry it took so long, but if you want to call back, call back. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. Scott, you've been very, very patient. I appreciate it. How you doing?
Thank you. I'm fine. Would you believe that I am not motivated to vote?
Yes, and that disappoints me greatly.
Okay. I think I last missed an election in 1974.
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion.
I look at voting like opening every morning at 8 a.m. I think of motivation as something temporary that comes from someone else.
Why don't you vote? Why do you
vote.
Think?
Oh, I you vote do in vote. Every election I can.
Oh, okay.
Yes, but I don't consider it a matter of motivation. It's a matter of commitment. It's like, as I said, it's like opening every morning at 8 a.m.
It's like going to your job.
Yeah, I think
it's a responsibility. You take it on.
Yeah, like
okay, good.
Going to a job. I'd like to see more Democrats look at it that way and act and do it that way. Now, the Democrats I know, I think pretty much do, but
I think most KPFT listeners
who don't like. There was a poor turnout of younger voters in this last city election, and Hero could have won with more younger voters.
Well, this could have won, that could have won. I've been thinking, I always think a lot about the turnout problem. Even presidential elections, we get about 65% of registered voters.
Yeah.
At a max.
Okay.
I mean, that's a great turnout.
Yeah.
I've begun to think, and of course it takes a party who believes in big turnouts rather than small turnouts.
Yeah.
But I've begun to think that as an experiment, I would like to see at least one county or perhaps one state do 30-day early voting where the early voting polls are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you don't have to find a precinct even on election day. You just go to one of these early voting places. And 30 days, 24/7. So if you work nights, if you work days, if you're a night person, if you're a lark and you get up at 4 a.m. to jog, you can go and just vote.
Yeah. Well, I started voting when I turned 21 and have voted in practically every election I had. I did miss 1970 because I moved back to Houston from Michigan. There was a residency problem. Missed and won special election 1974 because I couldn't find the voting place and I had to take the bus somewhere else.
That's fairly common.
Yeah, but practically every other election I had, I voted in.
I would say I probably vote in at a minimum And, of course, this is just grabbing out of thin air, but I think I probably vote in 80 to 90% of the elections. Every once in a while, for one reason or another, I'll miss one.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I try to vote in the primaries. I try to vote in the runoffs. I make a really strong effort, of course, to get into any general. So it's unusual for me to miss a voting opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid a lot of political discussion or discussion of elections is oriented toward people who just vote sometimes. And, well, they, for one thing, their interest is can be rather transient. They can be very, very excited about Obamacare at election time. And
speaking
then,
of which, I just want to say Obamacare, now is the time for you to look into registering healthcare.gov. So, folks, remember, healthcare.gov. We'll talk about it more as weeks go on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. They'll be interested in an issue in one election, and then they don't follow up with their elected officials. But there are lobbies who are...
Who always follow up.
Yes, they follow politicians year-round.
But, of course, they make a living doing that, whereas the average person has to take time out to do that.
Okay, they do. I was in the HERO campaign recently.
Mm-hmm.
There was paid staff. I thought it was a pretty good one. But I thought the advertising strategy was faulty. But I think the staff was very good at organizing volunteers.
But, of course, the voter turnout, again, is a problem.
Yeah, I did phoning. I was also, and in phoning, I was supposed to recruit volunteers. I had very little success with that. I did find quite a lot of people who were voting for HERO, at least they said so, and but I think it was a somewhat selected list. And HERO did win in District C of out of the 11 city council districts. And I think KPFT is in District C, and I certainly am. There was a core inside Loop 16 that voted for HERO, and quite a lot of it voted quite substantially. But outside that, the vote was against.
Mm-hmm. All right, Scott, I appreciate your calling. I'm going to let you go.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. It's open forum. So we've been talking about elections. We've been talking about positive reinforcement when you interact with people personally or professionally. We've been talking about HERO and elections and how to get people to churn out. I was listening to an interesting discussion the other night, and they were talking about how parties, the Democrats, but also to some extent, to a large extent, the Republicans, both parties work very hard on getting out their base. Let's talk about what the term base means in this context. There is a thing called a bell curve, and it's called a bell curve because when you draw it on a graph, that's what it resembles. It resembles a bell. When I was a supervisor, one of the things that we discussed was when you want to try to get an increase in performance for your department or your store or whatever, where do you focus your effort? And you don't focus your effort on the right side of the bell curve because those are the people, that tiny little number on the right-hand side that already excel. You tend to focus on the middle of the bell curve where people are doing sort of okay, and you're trying to get them to do better. And you figure those are the people to focus on because they already seem to have some of what it takes, and you figure they're the ones that can start to move to the right side of that bell curve. But when you start to look at it, the place to really look for big increases in performance is really on the left side of the bell curve. Because if someone is not being very productive and you can get them to double their productivity. And remember, we're talking about someone whose productivity is so low that doubling is a realistic objective. That's a huge difference. So I realize talk is cheap and elections are expensive. But a thought I would put out there is your base is going to turn out because that's the definition of a base. So you can spend a lot of effort getting your base to turn out, and it probably makes a percentage difference in terms of how much of your base turns out. The real challenge is getting the people on the left-hand side of that bell curve, the people that aren't registered or vote in presidential elections only or don't vote at all, because if you can get one of those people to vote twice as often instead of once every 4 years, once every 2 years, you've now doubled the size of that person's contribution to the electoral process. How can this be done? Well, I don't get paid the big bucks to figure that out. But I think we all need to focus more on the left side of the bell curve. Doing that can't be just a matter of shaking these people by the shoulders and telling them to get out and vote. So, you know, at the end of the day, whenever you have a policy, if you want that policy to work, you have to get what's called buy-in. People have to see something in that policy that they agree with, or that they feel gains them something, or in a meta sense gains their community or their group something. They have to buy into the plan. They have to buy into the idea. So how do you get people who are not involved in the political process to buy into the idea that their vote matters? I don't know that I have answers to that, but I think that you have to start by framing the question. One of the ideas that I put out there was this notion of early voting. For the 30 days prior to Election Day, you have early voting places that are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and even on Election Day, you don't have to go to a precinct. You can just go to these places. Like, I know that early voting, there are always several places that I can go to, this one, that one, or that one, depending on where my travels take me, and I vote and I'm done. And I think that we need to get out of this notion of precincts. You can tally votes by precincts. That's fine. You can motivate voters by precincts. That's great. But I think when it comes to voting, you should not have to find the guy's garage where the polling machines are this time. So I think that's one thing. I think that by having this 30-day, 24/7 voting opportunity, I think that might turn out voters. I would love to see a county try that and see if that really does make a difference in turnout. It would be a very, very interesting experiment. I would be interested in getting your ideas. Aside from just grabbing people by the shoulders and shaking them and telling them to vote, how do you get them to buy into the notion that voting is something they have a responsibility to do, they have an investment in doing, and that it affects their lives whether or not they do it? 713-526-5738. We do have open lines. I mentioned briefly during the last call with Scott that this is now the enrollment period for Obamacare, healthcare.gov. It is also the enrollment period for Medicare. So if you are 65 or older, or if you are going to be 65 and older, or if you have recently gotten disability, you may need or want to go to Medicare, the Medicare website, which I think is Medicare.gov, which is, and by the way, Medicare will take phone calls 24 hours a day, which is really cool. They do not close 24 hours a day if you have questions about Medicare. I believe the same is true of healthcare.gov. 24 hours a day, if you want to call with questions, what should I do? How should I look at this stuff? How can I evaluate it? They can't tell you what to do, but they can help guide you and direct you to places where you can get information, etc. Healthcare.gov, Medicare.gov. The elections are just passed. This is a good time to register or check to see if you're registered, if you have not voted recently. You can do that by going to harrisvotes.com or texasvotes.gov. And I strongly encourage people to do that. One of the things, on a totally different note, one of the things that I have talked about from time to time is Social Security and pensions and IRAs and 401ks and those sorts of things. And you've got this group of people in this country that has always hated Social Security and wants to privatize it. And you've got companies that cheated on pensions, which is why now we have 401ks, money they can't take away from you. But the fact is that 401ks, most people manage them poorly, if at all. You're lucky if they grow. You're lucky if they don't shrink. You're lucky if you have any money left in a 401k. I mean, there are people that invested their 401ks in Enron, okay? Just saying. The U.S. government now has something new, which is not what I've been advocating, which is a government pension plan you can invest in where you can take your 401k, this is my idea, where you can take your 401k and put it into a government pension plan with a guaranteed minimum return. This is as close as I have seen to something like that. The U.S. government now has something which they call MyRA.gov, M-Y-R-A, for like my IRA. And you can save any amount. There is no minimum deposit. It works on the same basis as a Roth IRA, which is to say that you have post-tax income, net income, that you invest in this. You're allowed to have as much as $15,000 in it. The average rate that you get, it goes into government treasury savings bonds. The average rate of return is about 2%, which sounds unimpressive until you realize that commercial banks are paying 0.01%, and a really, really good return from like an internet bank is like 0.75 or 0.8. So we're talking about something that is anywhere from, let's say, 3 to 2,000 times more than the interest rate you would get from a bank. So if you were just going to leave your money there and let it sit, 2% is actually pretty good based on what's available out there today. So it's from the Treasury Department. You can go to my, let me see, I'm just looking for the exact thing which I highlighted. Here we go. MyRA.gov, and you can get the necessary information there. And I do have a link to the article on my website, thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org, and you can go there, and under the relevant information section of the show post, you can link on that article. Another thing, headline from the Chronicle, why some Christians are upset at Starbucks' new holiday cups. War on Christmas! War on Christmas! So they want Starbucks to say Merry Christmas instead of apparently nothing. It's just green and red cups. And a point I want to make is, do they know that the CEO of Starbucks is Jewish? And they're lucky that he's not putting menorahs on their freaking cups? Just saying. Okay, next caller we have, and I'm just going to do a quick ID. This is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My engineer is Egberto Willis, who does PDR, Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4. And I want to plug Jeff Berg, who does Partisan Gridlock, Fridays from 3 to 4. Great show. Gary, you're up next. How are you doing?
Speaking of Jeff Berg, do you listen to his show?
I'm like most people. I listen to the radio when I'm in the car. I am usually not in the car at 3 p.m.
All right, well, I spoke to Jeff last week, and he is advocating what he feels is, he believes in mandatory voting. How do you feel about that? Because I called him, and I told him that if you want to have mandatory voting, then how do you feel about mandatory church attendance, which I'm sure Ben Carson would concur with, and a lot of people. How do you mandate anything in a free society? So I was curious what your take on it was, because you obviously are very intent on advocating voting, which I don't disagree with. It's our responsibility in a free democracy. But it's a difference, you know, not voting is a vote in itself, is it not?
Yes.
Okay.
The now, absence the comment. Absence of a thing is still a thing.
All right. Okay. Now, my other thing is, you know, people were talking about the potential for global climate change 40 years ago, and nobody ever listened or they actively tried to prevent it.
Okay. Actually, I'm going to just break in there for a moment. 40 years ago, they were talking about global warming. Which is, in fact, what's happening. It was the conservatives who kind of twisted progressives and liberals into changing to climate change, which sounds much more generic and less threatening than global warming. Global warming is actually what's happening.
All right. Well, the point is, and you're absolutely correct, it is a rejection of science. People ask me when I get into theological debates, what religion are you? I say, well, I don't know. Is science a religion? I mean, you look at the, we had this discussion last week. Well, I wanted to address the immigration issue from the point of view of science. You know, those who have vision are not appreciated till 50 years later when their vision comes true.
Yeah,
now,
that's true.
We're talking about immigration in 1950s terminology, okay, about the right of refugees and compassion for other people and people coming here for whatever reason, economic or otherwise. However, nobody's looking down the road and saying, okay, well, now we don't have a 1950s world. We have 7.5 billion people on the world. No, it's this religion, that religion, Muslims, Christians, Jews. But look at what's happening now. Have you ever been to Europe? Didn't you enjoy going to England, where they speak English, and France, where they speak French?
I have been to China. I have never been to Europe. I would love to go to England, although I'm still not sure I would understand them.
But the point is, you know, don't you appreciate the individuality of each and every culture? But if a culture like Germany that is becoming just completely inundated by another culture, doesn't that threaten the existing culture?
Well,
in other words, you have to look at it from the big picture, not what's happening with the individuals coming today, but what's happening to where they go 50 years from now.
Well,
I mean,
first of all,
I'm saying we're not looking at the big picture and incorporating the concept of overpopulation with the reality of immigration.
Well, of course, from a conservative's standpoint, and
I'm not a conservative.
Hold on, you got to let me talk, Gary. Let's put it this way: from the standpoint of a national native, however you want to define that, overpopulation. If you're in a country that has lots of space and you don't have high prices and housing is affordable, overpopulation is somebody else's problem. Why are they having so many babies? I think that's the attitude. But I think that the analogy that you make to a 1950s immigration world is not the analogy that we should be talking about today. The analogy we should be talking about is late 19th and early 20th century America, where the population within a matter of like 50 years practically doubled almost exclusively because of population. I mean, think about this. When the United States was founded in 1776, 1790, however you want to count it, the population, the European population of North America was about 11 million people. And 125 years later, it was like 100 million people. And a lot of that, most of that perhaps, was from immigration, but especially in that period where we had like 20 or 30 million people come into this country in the space of 30 or 50 years. That's what we're looking at now. We're looking at massive movements of large populations of people that are not like the people already living there. This was a WASP country. I mean, you had Jews and you had Native Americans and you had blacks, but this was basically a much more WASP country before the 1870s, 1890s, when you had Southern Europeans who were Catholic, or you had Irish who were Catholic, or you had Russians who were Orthodox or Jewish. And then all of a sudden you had a lot of cultural conflict. That's the equivalent to what we're seeing. And maybe that's where we need to look for guidance in terms of how we handle the situation. Egberto, you look like you're about to want to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what Gary is saying about, okay, German culture is going to change because of the influx of people that are coming in. That is so true, but America has changed cultures as well. The distinctiveness of a culture in itself is not what we should be aspiring for. I mean, what we get is changed cultures. I can guarantee you that the German culture of today, even as white as it is quite a bit different than the German culture 500 years ago.
You want to know something? Immigration.
Wait, now you're absolutely correct, because this has been occurring throughout history. The irony of the Hungarians rejecting the people coming from Syria is that Hungary was settled by the Huns. Okay. Why they call it Hungary?
Well, actually, the Magyars came in there.
The
Magyars came in there and also made their contribution.
Right, and English is Anglo-Saxon. Well, they were Germans.
It was the Angles and the Saxons, and they displaced the Celts. And then you had the Danes and the Norse and the Swedes come in and the Vikings, and that's why you've got so many blonde, fair-haired.
Exactly.
Brits and Irish, and the so-called Black Irish are actually closer to the original settlers.
Well,
but
the
fact that
they
are settlers means that they immigrated.
I'm saying, this is a normal phenomenon, migration. It happens with other animals, and it happens with humans, and it's always been this way. Russia is named after Vikings, the Rus.
Yep. Yep.
And the Rus went in and kicked whoever was there first out.
And actually, they then migrated down to the Balkans. So, but there's always conflict, and there's always displacement. And hold on, Gary. And in the short term, there are always winners and losers, at least in the short term.
But we're looking at history. That's what I was saying. Okay, we have the history of Earth is migration. But we didn't have 7 billion people. Now we're either going to all become a generic oneness, where we're all one, like everybody.
We're all going to look Hawaiian. That's been my theory. In 400 years, we're all going to look Hawaiian.
Is this good?
Gary, I got to let you go.
Is it good? Answer the question.
It is good, Gary.
It's good to have mercy on those that need help. But if you want to feed someone that comes to your door, you give them something to eat. But if 800
But you don't take them into your
door,
house necessarily,
you
and that's the thing.
Do
Gary,
give up
Gary,
everything?
I got another caller, and we're running out of time, so I apologize. I have to let you go.
Okay, you answer the question before the show's over.
The question I will answer about the election, I don't think mandatory voting for me would be a final resort. It is not something that I would prefer to see. That was your first question. Okay, just give me a moment here. Okay, I think this is going to be my last station ID, ThinkWing Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. I'm here with Egberto Willis. He does his PDR show Thursdays at 3 to 4, Politics Done Right. Alex, okay, why don't you talk for a minute and I'm just going to rest.
All right. First off, I was your mysterious dial tone last week.
Ah.
Yeah, so I thought I'd come and make up for that.
Okay.
And so on that topic, it was the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes.
And I read it was a terrific anecdote someone posted on one of the social media sites that got linked to me eventually, and I agree wholeheartedly with what this man said. And what it is that the Black Lives Matter movement is like you sit down to dinner with your family, and your dad passes out all the food except for you, and you look up and you say, I want my fair share. And your dad looks at you in direct response and says, everybody wants their fair share. And so when somebody says all lives matter, it's just ignoring the problem that, yeah, we all understand that all lives matter. What I'm trying to say is Black Lives Matter, too.
I think that the problem with the phrase Black Lives Matter and the equivalent problem with the phrase all lives matter is they are all partial statements of what most people mean. To me, And forgive me if I upset anybody out there, but this is, I'm speaking not only for myself, but for people that I think probably feel the way I do. I think what Black Lives Matter intends to mean is that Black lives matter as much as white lives. That is, I think, the implication, if you were to speak that in a full sentence. And I think that if all lives matter were to make a complete sentence, it would be all lives should matter equally. Now, I have spoken on this show many times how horrible some of the injustices are that we have seen on video. And I think the problem is that we have a number of people that agree but are separated by terminology. Now, wait a second. Egberto is giving me hand gestures, which I'm terrible at reading. So just tell me what you're thinking.
Look, I want to commend Alex to the nth degree because Alex said something is very important. And I understand what you're saying. And everybody understands what you're saying, Mike.
Everybody I don't know does. That everybody does.
Everybody does. Because, the thing about it is if you listen to what what Alex just said, and that is the importance of what he said.
I think he gave a great analogy.
But here's the thing. Until white people that do not see that. In fact, you need it to be in the phrase Black Lives Matter that way. Because when we reach the point that the white folks that don't understand the concept gets it, then we would have actually resolved the issue. But until then, your comment simply gives somebody an out.
I would rather that the phrase be Black Lives Matter as much as white lives, because that's it. That is what is meant. That is what is intended. And I agree with the intent. I just wish it was clearer.
Mike, I know you, and that's the reason why I don't walk into your part of the studio and say, what's wrong with you? I know your heart. That's not the issue here.
What is the issue then?
The issue here is you not accepting the terminology because of your preconceived notions. And Alex instead, what Alex went ahead and did is he went and read and understood a construct that really gave him the insight to why it is done the way
it is. Let me tell you why we are in at least phraseological disagreement here, okay? Is because I'm an old white guy and you're a middle-aged black guy. And I'm not going to assume where Alex is coming from. But I'm sorry?
Yeah, 25. Black.
He's 25, okay. Black guy.
So you're a young black guy. So, I mean, we have really three very different perspectives here. As an old white guy coming from a very different era and very different beliefs, yeah, and I'm going to have to wrap this up, I think it's important that people make clear. I think most white people would get behind Black Lives Matter as much as white lives. I think that it has been twisted that the implication of that, when you simply say Black Lives Matter, it allows many white people to be misled into the preconception that black lives are supposed to matter more, which of course is not what it means.
Okay, yes. Can I just...
No.
I got
4 seconds, man.
It's a succinct. It's a really simple, succinct way of putting it. It's a rather long post, anecdote, whatever.
Okay.
And what the key here is, like, whenever I say it, whenever I get into a conversation or need to post about it or anything else, the best way to solve this problem is to
put it all into
Black Lives Matter too.
Okay. I got to let you go at that point because we're running over time as it is. Thank you so much for calling, Alex. Call next week. We'll talk some more. Thank everybody for calling. And I guess I'm going to wrap this up with say what you mean and mean what you say, and let's not have any confusion. No shorthand, please. Have a great week. I'll talk to you Monday.
A nonprofit organization that helps refugee farmers start their own urban farming businesses within Houston city limits. All produce is grown using organic gardening methods, and we offer weekly shares of produce from farms. Planet Forward's next season will begin the week of December 28th, 2015. In a weekly share, you will receive 6 to 8 different varieties of freshly harvested vegetables grown using organic gardening methods. You can visit www.planetforward.org for more information. KPFT, Houston. KPFT is seeking Spanish language programming for its schedule. KPFT needs your voice for the best programming possible. Interested? Send an email to the program director, pd@kpft.org.
La estación de radio KPFT quiero programación en español. Necesitamos su voz para la mejor programación posible. ¿Interesante? Envía un correo electrónico a el director de programación, pd@kpft.org. Gracias. KPFT.